Welcome back to White Coats Real Talk. Heart disease is the number one cause of death in the United States and the world. Someone loses their life to a heart condition about every 34 seconds. But the story doesn't end there, because today we understand more about the heart than ever before. Welcome back. I'm Athara.
And I'm Atharva. Today, we're honored to speak with one of the leading voices in cardiovascular medicine. Today, we have Dr. Edward K. Casper. He has recently become the Chair Professor in Cardiology and has held the Anders Chair for 18 years. He's also the Professor in Cardiology and the Director of Outpatient Cardiology at Johns Hopkins. He spent a career caring for patients with heart failure, cardiomyopathy, and life-threatening heart conditions. He's helped shape how we diagnose and treat heart disease, co-authored the well-known book Living Well with Heart Failure to help patients and families live healthier, longer lives. We're so excited to talk to you today. How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you guys?
We're great.
We're great.
Terrific. I'm not so sure that my book, Living Well with Heart Failure, is all that famous or
It's a
well
good
known, but I thank you for the consideration, at least.
I'm sure it's still amazing, and I would love to read it. So, without further ado, let's just dive right into today's episode. So, first of all, heart disease is the number one killer worldwide. When you see that every 34 seconds someone dies from a heart condition, what does this statistic mean to you as a doctor in this field?
Yeah, it's one of the reasons why I went into medicine. It's a place within the field of medicine where there's a clear need, where you can clearly help people, and where science informs what it is that we do on a day-to-day basis. So when I hear that there are so many people with heart disease, what I think is there's much work to be done.
Amazing. And so we hear heart disease and heart failure used all the time. Can you explain the difference in a simple, clear way for our listeners to understand?
Sure. So heart disease is a category. It's heart disease, kidney disease, liver disease. And underneath this category called heart disease, there are a lot of disorders of various organs, various parts of the heart. So heart failure is actually not a disease. It's a constellation of signs and symptoms. So it's shortness of breath, fluid retention, things that you can measure, like jugular venous pressure and peripheral edema, and things that the patients tell you, like, I can't walk down the block without stopping because I'm short of breath. This constellation of signs and symptoms has many causes, and those many causes fall under the category of heart disease.
Well, that certainly clears it up. And obviously, you've treated thousands of patients. What's something about the heart that would genuinely surprise most people?
I think the thing that maybe not, doesn't surprise people, but certainly people don't recognize, is that in our lifetime, if you live to be an average age man or woman, your heart will beat about 2.5 to 3 billion times. And the fact that it doesn't make more mistakes over the course of this 3 billion beats is actually pretty fascinating. It works, and it works very well for a very long period of time.
And so, going back to heart disease, people think it happens suddenly, but damage often builds silently for years. How does the heart disease really begin?
So let's narrow our discussion of heart disease to coronary artery disease or atherosclerosis of the coronary arteries, although atherosclerosis can occur in the carotids, in the abdominal aorta, down the legs as well. It doesn't tend to happen in the arms, and that's an interesting fact because it will happen in the subclavian arteries that lead to the arms. But if you were to say, when does atherosclerosis begin? It begins in your teenage years. Both of you may have, depending upon your diet and physical exercise and other things, you may have the beginnings of atherosclerosis, usually in your abdominal aorta right now. And we know this from autopsies done on young soldiers in Vietnam and Korea, where they discovered the beginnings of atherosclerosis in these young soldiers. So the presentation of a heart attack is a bang moment, but getting to that point takes decades of atherosclerosis and building up of cholesterol plaques and whatnot to get to a point where one of them ruptures in a coronary artery, and boom, you're off to the races with what we call a myocardial infarction, also known as a heart attack.
Are there any early warning signs that we can notice beforehand to try and prevent this or get help soon?
Yeah, so the early warning signs of a heart attack are chest tightness or constriction that comes on with exertion and goes away with rest. That we call classic exertional angina or angina. I use the term angina. And that's a warning sign that cholesterol plaques are present and that they're severe enough to cause flow restriction down coronary arteries. At your age, there are no signs and symptoms. Usually, there are those who have inborn errors of cholesterol metabolism who present with heart attacks at age 9 and 10, but those are few and very far between. So at your age, the key is, are you living a healthy lifestyle? Is your diet good? Do you get regular exercise? Are you sleeping appropriately? All of these things are important. Obesity, all of this is important at a young age to help prevent the development of atherosclerosis, or at least push it down the road, and prevent obesity, diabetes, hyperlipidemia, high cholesterol, all the risk factors for coronary disease.
Yeah, I completely agree that living a healthy life will really delay these and maybe not present in your body. And so you really talked about like high blood pressure and diabetes. So how does it exactly damage the heart or harm the heart before symptoms appear?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. How does a normal coronary artery or abdominal aorta become abnormal? And the likelihood there is that it's injury to the endothelium. So the innermost lining of any vessel is called the endothelium. And initially, when people looked at this under the microscope, they thought of the endothelium as being kind of paving stones. They were just inert things that separated things inside the vessels from things inside the vessel wall. And in fact, that couldn't be further from the truth. The endothelium, each endothelial cell, is a little factory that makes things that prevent blood from clotting and from LDL cholesterol from getting into the vessel wall. All this can be injured by things such as nicotine in cigarettes or pipe tobacco, obesity. There are factors that come along with obesity. High blood pressure can do it. And once these endothelial cells are injured, that sets up the process, which is fairly stereotypical. Cholesterol gets driven in by a concentration gradient from the bloodstream into the vessel wall. It builds up. Inflammation occurs because these lipid-laden macrophages called foam cells attract inflammatory cells, and then this combination of inflammation and cholesterol creates what for all the world looks like a zit, one of those zits you really want to pop, with a big one. When those zits pop in a coronary artery, it exposes the stuff, the gruel that's on the inside, to the bloodstream, and that what has the bloodstream decided, designed to do? Well, it's designed to clot if it sees something other than normal endothelial cells. And that clot can occlude the blood vessel. That occlusion can lead to death of the cardiac myocytes or cardiac cells that are served by that now clotted off blood vessel. And that's what we call a heart attack.
Another heart disease that we hear about a lot is cardiomyopathy. Could you kind of explain what the disease is and how it works?
Sure. So it's a combination of Greek terms, cardios meaning heart, myos meaning muscle, and the opathy part meaning affliction. So it's a primary disease of the heart muscle. And it can come in a number of different flavors, kind of like ice cream, chocolate, strawberry, and vanilla. The most common is called a dilated cardiomyopathy, where usually the left ventricle, the major pumping chamber of the heart, gets enlarged, it dilates, and the wall motion or the pumping power of the heart measured by something called the ejection fraction, is decreased. That causes heart failure symptoms. The second kind of cardiomyopathy is hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, when the three of us decide we want to get into weightlifting because we want our biceps to be really big and bulgy. What we're going to do is cause our bicep muscles to hypertrophy. And the hypertrophied muscle in hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is the heart muscle, the left ventricular muscle. And so if dilated cardiomyopathy is kind of the 98-pound weakling who at the beach, everyone kicks sand in their face, the hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is the weightlifter at the beach who can't bend over and touch his or her toes because they're so inflexible because of the bulging muscles. Not a problem that I've ever had. And then the third form is a type of cardiomyopathy that's neither dilated nor hypertrophied, yet occurs with very restricted cardiac filling, left ventricular filling. That's called restrictive cardiomyopathy. There are some other rarer forms of cardiomyopathy, arrhythmogenic right ventricular dysplasia, this, that, and the other thing. But those are the main categories, those three or four. And what's the most common symptom of all these? Well, it's that constellations of signs and symptoms that we call heart failure. It's shortness of breath when you exert yourself. It's swelling of the ankles. It's elevation of the jugular pressure, which a doctor can read in your neck. It's swelling of the abdomen. It's shortness of breath. It's the inability to lay down flat without getting short of breath at night. It's waking up at night suddenly so short of breath you have to sit up. All of this, are part and parcel of the signs and symptoms that we call heart failure.
I see. And this is a really good analogy. And so I know that cardiomyopathy is challenging to diagnose early. Why is that? And how does it act like a silent disease before actually diagnosing it?
Yeah, so it partly depends upon the population that you're looking at. There's something called Bayes' theorem, which says that the pretest, the post-test probability depends upon the pretest probability. So if I go looking for coronary disease in high school students with a stress test, the most common problem found in a positive stress test in people your age would be a false positive. It's an artifact of some sort or another. Yet, if we go looking for the same stress test in someone my age who's got all the signs and symptoms of coronary disease, a negative stress test is not informative. It is probably a false negative. So the pretest probability informs the post-test probability. This is Bayes' theorem, BAYES, Bayes' theorem. And how does that apply to cardiomyopathy? Well, oftentimes we see the presentation of cardiomyopathy in younger folks. In younger folks who are short of breath, it's much more common to have an upper respiratory tract infection or COVID or influenza or something, bronchitis, pneumonia. And so these patients often get treated as if they've got a respiratory infection before anyone lights on the concept that, look, this might be a cardiomyopathy. It's a little easier, I think, to diagnose in older patients, where the most common cause of a cardiomyopathy in someone my age is probably coronary disease, a history of prior infarcts. And because of that, there's a history. There's a story that's being told. And cardiomyopathy is sort of a part of the middle to end of the story, not the very beginning of the story. So the reason why cardiomyopathies in young people are difficult to diagnose is that people aren't thinking of them. And in older people, I think it is fairly easy. And the key thing is get an echo, an echocardiogram, a sonogram of the heart. Let's take a look at how the heart structure and function is and see if the walls are contracting nicely. And with an echo, within 2 minutes, you'll know whether you're dealing with a dilated cardiomyopathy or not. I can take, I teach the second year medical school course in the cardiovascular system at Johns Hopkins and have for almost 20 years at this point. And I can take a classroom full of medical students and show them a normal echocardiogram and then have them tell me whether there's a dilated cardiomyopathy present or a normal echocardiogram present within about 5 minutes. This is not difficult stuff to sort out at all. These are second-year medical students. So hypertrophic is also pretty easy to diagnose on echo, usually, not always. Restrictive can be very difficult. That's a much more tricky thing. Thankfully, it's the least common.
Yeah, that's definitely really cool to hear, and it obviously shows how much expertise that you have in your career. But cardiomyopathy, what's like the next step after like diagnosing which type it is? How does the treatment process begin, and what kinds of like treatments are you guys using for specific versions of it?
Yeah, so these days I feel really comfortable about treating patients with dilated cardiomyopathies because we have so many things in our armamentarium that we can use. When I was a medical student back in the early 1980s, there were arguments about whether someone should use digoxin or something called an ACE inhibitor. And this would be a controversial discussion at, say, cardiology grand rounds in medical school. And these days, I think we have a very good idea what patients with dilated cardiomyopathy, particularly those who are symptomatic, should be on. And that's a combination of four drugs, which we don't really need to go into, I don't think. But all four of these drugs have been shown to prolong life, decrease symptoms, and have great support in large randomized controlled, placebo-controlled trials where part of the patients get the drug, part of it get placebo, and we don't know. It's all blinded. Both the investigators and the patients don't know what they're getting. And with that kind of scientific background, we know that these four drugs work. In addition to that, there is the use of defibrillators, which recognize abnormal rhythms that are deadly and can shock you out of it. There are also different kinds of defibrillator associated with pacemakers, depending upon you want the heart to squeeze all at once like this. And sometimes the heart can develop an asynchronous contraction when first one wall contracts while the other is relaxing, and then the other wall contracts while the first wall is relaxing. And this sort of asymmetric contraction can be fixed with pacemakers, pacemaker leads on both sides of the heart. So if the heart starts contracting altogether once again, that's called chronic resynchronization therapy. And then if, worse comes to worse, there are left ventricular assist devices, heart transplantation, whole host of things that we can do, but thankfully rarely have to do.
Based on medical breakthroughs that are currently happening, do you believe that we're getting any closer to diagnosing this condition before symptoms even happen?
Yes, well, we can do that now. About, I would say, somewhere maybe upwards of 50% of patients with a dilated cardiomyopathy are diagnosed and are largely, if not completely, asymptomatic. They get an echocardiogram for some other reason, and lo and behold, they've got a cardiomyopathy, a dilated cardiomyopathy. The same is true with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which is, both of these diseases, all three actually, but particularly dilated and hypertrophic cardiomyopathy have clear-cut genetic components. And so we know within families, let's just say mom presents with a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, we do genetic testing on her. We know that the transmission is autosomal dominant. That means somewhere in the neighborhood of half the kids will have a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy or carry that pathologic variant as well. And so we can then do echocardiograms, we can do genetic testing on them, and focus more closely on those who have the pathologic variant. And at that point, we know they've got the pathologic variant, but their echo could be completely normal. And we can follow those patients along. I think at some point, we'll be at a point where we can actually change the gene so that they don't develop hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, but that's research dreaming right now.
Yeah, I feel like progressing really fast, and there's a lot of medical technologies that I feel like in the next 5 to 10 years will really change the field. Your book is called Living Well with Heart Failure. So, what does that living well truly mean to you when caring for patients with chronic heart conditions that they've been having?
Yeah, and so it's not important what it means to me. It's important what it means to the patients. So some patients want to live their lives doing exactly what they've always done. That might be running triathlons, doing whatever. Others are very happy with a much more sedentary lifestyle. So living well is designed or defined rather by the patient and what they feel is living well. My job as a physician is to help them live the best life that they want to live. Realizing, of course, that part of my job is to make sure that they do the kinds of things that will help their disease in the long run. So exercise, stopping smoking, don't drink alcohol, don't do drugs, all these kind of things. If someone wants to do all of them, and that's their definition of a good life, I won't be helping them do it. But for other people who are quite happy going to the grocery store, seeing their grandkids, all that stuff, and have no intention whatsoever of running a marathon, that's fine. That's their definition of a good life. It happens to be mine as well. I don't run marathons.
What do you think is the most overlooked daily habit that protects the heart? Something many patients don't realize matters as much as it does.
Exercise. I think without a doubt, the single most important thing that we could all do better is exercise every day. And I would include in that both aerobic and resistive training. So something that gets your heart rate up, running, elliptical, stationary bike, swimming. I personally kind of favor walking or running because that's anti-gravity. Sitting on a bike is not anti-gravity. And then something resistive so that you maintain your core musculature. I think both of those things are important. If I could magically snap my finger, however, and get rid of one thing in our entire population, it would be smoking. I think that smoking in and of itself is the single worst thing that you could do, and exercise is probably the single best thing that you could do.
Yeah, I completely agree that exercise is really important. And in fact, I see a lot of people smoking and feel like it really takes a toll on their health. And so patients often underestimate different parts of treatment, or they might not get used to different parts. What do you think people struggle with the most? For example, medications, sleep, diet, or anything else part of the treatment process?
Yeah, so what I try to teach patients is to take one step at a time, to deal with the thing that's immediately before you, and to not think 12 steps down the road. How does this play out? Well, don't worry about a heart transplant if we're at the beginning of this. Let's worry about getting you on the right medicines, changing your diet, changing your lifestyle, getting you to exercise more. And we'll worry about those other things when the time comes. And I think that's the first mindset that patients need, people need, which is deal what's in front of you first, do it well, follow directions, take your medications, change your diet, exercise, and then from there, we'll deal with the next problem as it comes up, and then the next problem as it comes up. I think those are that kind of mindset, which is there'll be a hurdle, but I can jump over it. And tell me, doc, what you want me to do, and I'll do it. That kind of mindset is benefits everybody.
If you had to summarize the main message of your book, for listeners or anyone that's reading your book for patients with heart disease, what would that message be?
The first is that there's hope. We have lots that we can offer today. The second is it's important to make an early diagnosis. The third is that we have lots of treatments, and those treatments could be medical or device related and could extend even up to heart transplantation. That it's important to follow an appropriate diet, exercise, not smoke, don't drink alcohol, There are things that you can do for yourself that can make you better or help you stay better or get better. And that genetics is important. It may not be necessarily important for you individually, but it could be important for your family and other first-degree relatives. I think those would be the major messages of the book. The book is actually written a number of years ago at this point, and a lot of it's out of date. But the main message, which I just went through, that's not out of date. That's as true today as it was back then, which is hope.
Completely agree that hope's a really powerful thing when going through such a hard time. And do you have any like powerful patient stories that stuck with you throughout all your whole career until now?
One of the things that makes cardiology fun for me is the development of longitudinal relationships. So I'm not a surgeon. I don't go in and take an appendix out, close them up, and see them in a month, and that's the end of my relationship. I have been practicing cardiology since 1991, and I've got a handful of patients that I've followed for nearly all that time. And some of these patients become friends. So, thinking in particular of a young man and woman who I met after the birth of their first child and after the birth of my first child, first and only child, and their first and only child as well. And how, I have walked with him through a heart transplant and then a second heart transplant and then a kidney transplant, and all these years later. And it turns out that our sons, they're both boys, our sons were in the neonatal intensive care unit together at the same time. We didn't know each other at the time, but we later figured out at the same, the same week, they were both there. And the boys ended up growing up and playing lacrosse together, later in life on certain club lacrosse teams. They went to different rival high schools, but they played summer lacrosse together. And that's really neat, the ability to create those kinds of relationships is something very special.
I think it's absolutely insane how fate works and how you meet people in your life that stay with you for such a long time. And obviously, the medical field, you meet so many different people and you have like very long-lasting relationships, as long as far as what I've heard.
Yeah, it's very true. The relationships, the relationships are really what make it all. I mean, why do you stay at a place like Johns Hopkins, for your entire career? Not entirely true. I was at Vanderbilt for 2 years, but the vast majority of my career, why have I stayed there? And the answer is, it's the people I work with. It's the patients I take care of. It's the people I get to know. The administrators, the nurses, the social workers, it sounds trite, but it becomes like a family. And
No, that's amazing.
it has been, the source of great both inspiration and satisfaction
Yeah,
for me.
I can only imagine. And you mentioned like your colleagues and people you work with. Based off of that, do you have any mentors that helped you along your journey in
Oh,
medicine?
yes. Every year,
Yeah.
I had a mentor of one sort or another, dating back to my parents. I have fewer mentors today. Clearly, I'm in the last third of my career, probably even last fifth of my career, and I don't need a mentor right now. But pretty much every major decision along the way was made with the help of, I'd say, substantially. A handful of people, many of whom I'm still in touch with today, I still see as friends. One, Tom Trail, is when he retired a year or so ago, his grateful patients donated enough money for the Trail Chair in cardiology, and I'm the inaugural Trail Chair holder. So, having mentors is important in life. And making connections is important. That's what you two, I think, are doing much better than I. Well, number one, I would never have had the ability to have a podcast, but the very notion of reaching out to a doctor at Johns Hopkins from Austin, Texas, getting on the phone because there wasn't any email, getting on the phone and talking to some doctor at Johns Hopkins was be so foreign to me as a high school student as to, I might as well have said, well, tomorrow I'm going to grow wings and fly. It wouldn't have occurred to me. And this process of socialization and creating mentorships and relationships around medicine, I think what you guys are doing here with this podcast is spectacular.
Thank you
I
so much.
congratulate you.
Thank you so much. Those words mean like a lot to us. It's coming from someone as prestigious as yourself. And one of our last questions. Did you ever think of a different specialty while going into medical school? Because I've heard obviously your ideas change a lot. And, or maybe did you even think of a different career before medicine?
Well, I thought for a while that I would be the center fielder for the New York Yankees, but that didn't play out very well. That's not very true. Eighth grade, this is a great story. So my eighth grade, no, seventh grade human biology teacher really triggered a love of human biology in me. And her name was Louise Pasteur, Lois Pasteur. Louise Pasteur. To this day, and from that moment on, from seventh grade, I knew I wanted to be a doctor. I didn't know what kind of doctor, except I wanted to be a good one. But I, nobody in my family was a doctor. My father was an artist. He painted portraits, sports work. He was an artist. My mother was a nurse, so there was a little bit of that then. And when I first got to Johns Hopkins as an undergraduate, I wanted to do research, and I kind of fell into doing research in a neuropathology lab. A man named Don Crist, who became sort of my first medicine mentor. And I went to medical school assuming I'd be a neuropathologist. And I can tell you that nobody thinks that they're going to be a neuropathologist except for me and maybe some kids of neuropathologists. I mean, most of us didn't know what neuropathology was. And I very quickly realized in medical school that I liked dealing with patients. And the problem with being a neuropathologist is that if you're looking at someone's brain, the likelihood is that they're not alive. And so I thought, well, I'll be a neurologist, right? And there's a lot to neurology that's similar to cardiology in the sense that they both have great physical exams that inform clinical decision making, deciding where the lesion is or what valvular disease by auscultating or banging on people's knees with reflex hammers, the great exams. And to this day, I still love the physical exam of the heart. The difference was that in neurology at that time, once you thought that the stroke was in this part of the brain and you got a CAT scan and proved the stroke was in this part of the brain, that was it. There was nothing to do about it. Whereas in cardiology, you could puzzle something out and there was something that you could then do about it. You could replace a valve, you could do bypass surgery, you could do a heart transplant. There were medicines, there were things that you could do. And then finally, I ended up really liking the patients with cardiac disorders. It appealed to my sense of order, and I'm a very orderly kind of guy. You could follow things along. So that combination of physical exam, plus the diseases that a cardiologist takes care of, plus the long-term relationships, plus great mentors as colleagues, all of that sort of ended up in this pathway called cardiology.
Amazing. And it's very funny and like how coincidental your biology teacher was the similar name as the famous biologist and chemist, which is really cool.
Yes.
And so, yeah, it's really funny. And so, for our last question, for students interested in medicine, maybe high school, undergrad, even people who go into medicine, what advice do you have on how to be successful in this field and mindsets that help you succeed in this field?
Yeah, so I think the first thing is to try to experience as much of medicine as you are allowed to experience. I mean, you're not going to be able to walk in and do a heart operation, but you can participate in volunteer work at a local hospital, local clinic. You could help take blood pressures at screening tables, at festivals, churches, all that kind of stuff. And I think getting a sense of what medicine might be like is an important thing early on. And so that would be my first thing. I would also say that you should probably do some research, that somewhere in college or medical school, what you're doing in medicine should intrigue you enough that you want to ask and then answer questions. And if you've got a lot of questions and you're really intrigued, that probably means that medicine's the right place for you. I mean, that sense that there are fun things to pursue here and questions that you really want to answer, that's a good thing. Yeah, I think those would be the two major things that I would suggest for young people.
Well, Dr. Casper, thank you so much for being here on today's episode. We clearly learned a lot from all kinds of heart disease and to the symptoms and then procedures and even your own life story. And I'm sure our viewers and listeners have learned just as much. Do you have any last words for anyone listening?
Yes, I do. And that is Miss Pasteur. If you're out there and you're listening to this podcast, contact me. I've been trying to reach you for 20 or 30 years. I would love to thank you in person. But the other thing that I would say about medicine in general is that it is a great profession. It's noble, it's thoughtful, it allows you to help people while using your interest in science. It's ever expanding, constantly evolving. You don't stop learning when you graduate from medical school. It's just the beginning. And personally, I like that. I think other people do as well. And don't be discouraged. Just keep moving forward.
Those are definitely some powerful words. And well, that's been White Coats Real Talk. I'm Akshara.
And I'm Atharva.
And we'll see you guys on the next episode.
Thank
Thank you.
you.